Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against to the glory of God and his kingdom. China is, of course, as usual, the main threat to the United States, the country we love, and its people. We have been beavering away for some time now to produce a book that will lay bare what the Chinese Communist Party has been doing to us and with the purpose of taking down our country. And it is now, I'm very pleased to say, available in bookstores everywhere. And we're very excited to explore what it's about, why it is, we believe, extraordinarily important at this moment in time, and some of the takeaways, in particular the action items about what we need to do in regard to, well, the Chinese unrestricted warfare that has been waged against us for decades to date, and the prospects of a new and vastly more dangerous shooting war, which Xi Jinping, the Chinese dictator, seems to have set his sights on perfecting and perpetrating. To do all of this, of course, we're very pleased to have a man who contributed mightily to this book in his myriad appearances as a contributor to our Committee on the Present Danger China's webinar series aimed at exploring both unrestricted warfare of the kind the Chinese, as I say, have engaged in to date, as well as their enablers here in the United States. His name is Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps retired, no stranger to this program for sure, as well as a very important contributor to our Committee on the Present Danger of China's work more generally. Grant is a former Foreign Service officer and business executive out in East Asia, where he resides. He is also the author of his own very important new book entitled When China Attacks, A Warning to America. Colonel Newsom, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for your many, many significant insights and recommendations that we've tried to capture in the indictment, prosecuting the Chinese Communist Party and friends for crimes against America, China, and the world. Welcome back, sir.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you very much.
So, Grant, you have studied so closely for so long, both in uniform as well as in the Foreign Service, of course, from your vantage point in Asia, what the Chinese are about. And just to calibrate, what is the abiding intent, long before Xi Jinping's time, but most especially under his, dictatorship, towards this country, as you see it, sir?
Well, it's to, at a minimum, dominate us. It's, at a maximum, destroy us. They've been very clear about it. It doesn't take a genius to figure this out. It was obvious at least 20 years ago to anybody who was paying attention, and longer than that. That's the objective. They've been very clear, not just Xi Jinping, before him, that the American system, this whole notion of American values, the things that we fought a revolutionary war for, you know, the individual freedoms, the liberties, that these are something that just are inimical to what the Chinese communists want. And the two cannot exist together, according to the Chinese, and it is a war against us. They've just called it something else or hidden it, and they've very successfully played to our vanity, stupidity, naivete, greed. And here we are. But as I say, this was obvious 20 years ago, and it's to dominate or get rid of us.
So if that's so, and I know that you and Captain Jim Fennell and many others that we feature on this program have been pointing this out for those two decades at least, if not more, why is it that we seem still so clueless about the fact that the Chinese have been at war with us, let alone what they might have in mind next?
Well, the smell of money will make a lot of people gladly become clueless. That's always been the case. This is human nature. But also there's a range of other reasons for this. You know, some people who just think that we have to do everything to accommodate China because the risk of nuclear war is just too much. There's still even a naive sense. It's a very American way of looking at things, that if we just talk some more, if we have lines of communication, if we engage with them, that we can work things out. A very American approach to things. And sort of the Will Rogers, I never met a man I didn't like, but here we've, for us, someone who says they want to kill us is just a friend we haven't made. So there's a few things at work here, ranging from money to, you know, just naivete. And really our, the nature of a lot of us is to just want to talk things out and work out a deal.
You have explored with me and in your own book and in innumerable other contributions to this debate, Colonel Newsom, this phenomenon of elite capture, as the Chinese call it. Some of it, yes, manifested by outright, well, purchases, I guess you'd say, of individuals. Joe Biden comes prominently to mind in this regard. But whether it's honey traps or whether it's ideological affinities or just sheer greed, as you say, we have had, and we really try to explore in some detail in this book, the friends of China that have been greatly enabling their march through our institutions and towards their ultimate goal of global hegemony. How would you characterize the magnitude of that problem as a contributor, not only to the, well, parlous state we've gotten ourselves into, but to an inducement to the Chinese to believe that they may be able to have their way fully with us?
Well, they've got good reason to believe that if they just keep up the work they've been doing, that they can just erode us from the inside, that they will have enough of their people, Americans, doing their bidding. And those people will be thinking that what they're doing is the just thing, the statesmanlike thing. And from a Chinese perspective, it looks like they're going to just might win without fighting. That's how successful they have been. And it's really hard to imagine, I think, for a lot of people who don't live and breathe the subject, that so many Americans would sell out their own country. And ultimately, for relatively small amounts of cash or a first-class air ticket and a few nights in a five-star hotel in Beijing at some seminar. That's how bad it is. It has been going on for decades. And it is indeed the friends of China. And that's what they refer to them as. And these are people who, you know, for whatever their motivations, you know, really are doing the Chinese Communist Party's bidding.
Yeah. I guess the point that you've just made, which is that most of us are unaware. I mean, there's the elite that are captured, yes, but most of us are unaware. And I guess to some extent, at my sort of conclusion in all of this has been, that's in part because the people that we, you know, assume are going to be alive to dangers like this, and certainly warning us about them. A war, for example, of the, you know, sort of pre-violent kind, or certainly the prospect of the kind that you've warned of in your new book, When China Attacks, the very violent kind, quite possibly. And yet, to the extent that the Chinese have successfully compromised or bought or at least silenced those, you know, people who are supposed to be, I guess, the canaries in the mineshaft, they have left us all in great peril indeed. Colonel, we have to take a very short break. When we come back, I want to talk to you more about that point you've just made about the problem, quite possibly here at home, as part of this war. Let's get to that in a moment. Stay tuned.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Chinese Communist Party is the United States' mortal enemy. It explicitly seeks America's destruction and has long pursued that goal using devastating, albeit pre-violent, unrestricted warfare techniques with help from their friends among American captured elites. Now the Chinese Communists appear poised to start a shooting war against Taiwan and almost certainly U.S. assets, personnel, and territory as well. Too many Americans are still unaware of these realities and what we must do to secure our country against them. I'm pleased to announce the publication today of my new book aimed at correcting that perilous situation. It's entitled The Indictment and a playbook for prosecuting the CCP and friends for their crimes against America, China, and the world. Get The Indictment wherever books are sold to learn how we can punish that transnational criminal organization and secure freedom. This is Frank Afton.
Welcome back. We have the privilege of being graced by Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps retired, one of our regulars and favorite participants in this program, a senior fellow, by the way, of our Center for Security Policy, for which we're very grateful, and of course the author most recently of When China Attacks, A Warning to America. Colonel, you touched in passing on a point that we're going to be drilling down on as we speak in a webinar this afternoon. As this program airs, it will be in the rearview mirror, but hopefully people will turn to the video of it, which should be available by the time this program airs. It's entitled Xi's Fifth Column. Has the Chinese Communist Party's physical assault on America already begun? And one of the things that we're going to be focusing in on as just a kind of introduction to the topic is the reports that we're now hearing with increasing frequency that among the enormous numbers of people who are coming into our country illegally are sizable numbers of military age, seemingly quite fit, young, unaccompanied men from China. And Michael Yan, one of our contributors to this webinar, a world-class, as you know, war correspondent, has had eyes on these guys as they're coming through the so-called Darien Gap in Panama to get here. And one of the things that he, as a astute reporter on these matters, has detected is that they all seem to be carrying the same kit, suggesting, I think it's fair to say, they didn't just meet up on the trail. Your thoughts, sir, on this particular part of what could be a very, very problematic development?
Well, I take it very seriously. One, Michael Yan's very good, but as I would take it very seriously, it's just an invasion from the southern border, which, well, there's no border, this invasion across what used to be the southern border. It is just a wonderful opportunity for any reasonably competent intelligence service. And the Chinese are at least very persistent and competent to infiltrate your people into the country that is your main enemy. And you put them in there. You might not even know when you're exactly going to need them, but you get them into the society. And you have them ready to go and cause trouble when the time comes, or even in the meantime, there's some of them that will be better trained and probably even actual outright agents that can do more sophisticated things. You know, you have them blend into American society. Remember how we were in a big fuss about these handful of Russian illegals who had come in here and set up like Americans for decades, and then we caught them. Well, that was like you could have fit all those people into like an old Ford Escort. There weren't many of them. But the Chinese do this on industrial scale as they want to do. So it is one more sort of avenue of attack. You know, if you're going after an enemy, you want to be able to attack him from as many directions as possible. And this is, I think, what we're seeing on the southern border. Not cracking down on this is not just malfeasance, it's just pure treason. I don't know of a better word to describe it, but this does have to be taken very seriously. Do the authorities or the administration have a handle on it? Well, if they do, it's a very, very well-kept secret.
Well, worse than that, what Alejandro Mayorkas, the Homeland Security Secretary, the man responsible for this border situation under President Biden, of course, would have us believe that there's absolutely no problem. The border is secure. It has been secure. It will be secure. Even after they remove on Thursday, I guess, this, temporary restriction imposed in connection with the COVID pandemic. But I just have to say, sir, that, it's bad enough if you have, competent intelligence operatives coming across in numbers. But these may be just plain old-fashioned People's Liberation Army elements that are going to be capable, trained, obviously, but also presumably when married up with gear, weaponry, and the like in this country, which, of course, is available in abundance, let alone what they may have stashed here or brought in surreptitiously otherwise. That's a whole nother category of problem. But we're going to argue in the course of the webinar, Colonel, that when you add on top of it the, by some estimates, 300,000 students that are in the United States, all of whom have been approved to be here by the People's Liberation Army, to say nothing of spies and businessmen and other Chinese nationals in our country, the prospects for a true fifth column of very considerable dimensions cannot be overstated, can it?
No, you really can't. And this is part of Chinese strategy. It's not anything new. You know, this is to be expected. And, really, of all the Chinese, one of the real tragedies of all of this, in a way, is that so many of the Chinese people are in America now came here to get the hell away from the Chinese Communist Party. And we have done absolutely nothing to protect those people from the Chinese communists. They have been able to operate into America, in America, to intimidate these people, thoroughly cow them, and make them disappear in some cases. Yeah.
Well, including with these overseas police service centers, as they call them.
Yeah.
That's the express purpose of those things, isn't it?
What you have, if you look at it from an intelligence perspective, you have this huge number of people of Chinese origin in the United States, and that is just wonderful cover. In there, you don't need to have everybody. You just need to have enough operating in this, this mass of people. And it makes it very hard for the Americans to figure out what's going on, to the extent they even want to. So they're taking advantage of it, and there's no reason why they wouldn't. And we have seen this before. As I say, if you go back and look at the Chinese Civil War, for example, when they would go after a target, they would get their people into the place. For when the time comes. And this is just one part of the fifth column that they've got. Unfortunately, a good chunk of the fifth column is also made up of native-born Americans who should know better.
Well, and that goes back to this topic of the book, the indictment. To the extent that we continue to allow captured elites, and that's their term for it. Others suggest that we ought to think of this as elite merger rather than capture, and I'm open to any other formulation, but that's what they call it. And as you say, that's what they've invested relatively small amounts of money, but plenty to achieve. But Colonel, as you look at this prospect, especially for heaven's sakes, that we may well find ourselves in a shooting war, what could it possibly portend that we have leaders of both our government and our business sector, including finance, of course, and the media, and, others, academia and so on, working for the other side. I mean, is it possible that, you know, that's anything other than a formula for our, well, I think, ignominious defeat?
Not really. You know, if you think of if we could do this to the other side, somebody that we're going after, we wouldn't even have to break a sweat. You know, we'd be laughing about it, just how easy it was. And I'm afraid that that is the case. You know, we've got to have the sense that, well, we always win. There's nothing to worry about. There's a sense the Chinese are just too stupid to ever be a threat to us. Well, they're as smart as we are. And, you know, and that's how bad it is. You know, it's something that most Americans can't even imagine.
No, I couldn't agree more with that. And I guess just a closing thought, it's not only all of that, but it's also almost certainly an inducement to the likes of Xi Jinping to think that, well, as I said earlier, he can have his way with us. We must disabuse him of that. That is the point of the indictment, mm-hmm. with its 20 action steps as to what needs to be done now. I think also the point of your book, When China Attacks. Colonel Grant Newsom, thank you for your time today. Come back to us again, sir, if you would. Well, speaking of academia, we're going to talk with one of the brightest of our academics about the danger of that enemy within, Michael Rechtenwald, right after this.
In cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa: Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa: Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest, Dr. Michael Rechtenwald, whom I had the privilege of actually meeting for the first time. We've talked on any number of occasions on this program and elsewhere, but for the first time, we actually met face-to-face at a marvelous conference that our friends at the American Freedom Alliance, led by Karen Sigeman, did, entitled The Third World War, The Early Years. And we're going to talk in a moment about some insights that Michael shared with us on that occasion that is now in the form of an essay that is required reading, I think, for everybody. Dr. Rechtenwald is an author of a number of very compelling books, and we will touch on some of those as well, including Thought Criminal, a discussion of his experience as a former Marxist professor at New York University, who was essentially driven out of the professoriate and has become a champion of freedom, I'm very happy to say, for the good guys. And welcome, as always, Michael. It's great to have you with us, sir.
Great to be here, Frank. Thanks for having me.
We were talking in the earlier segment with Colonel Grant Newsom a little bit about this enemy within problem, both at the sort of elite level, but also, you know, just the sheer numbers of Chinese nationals in this country, including students. And of course, you have worked with some of them at New York University and maybe elsewhere in your career. But I'm struck by the fact that not a one of those, some 300,000, got into this country without the permission and blessing of the Chinese Communist Party. And there's reason to believe that the party is making very clear to them that they are to serve it in whatever way they're called upon. Give us your insights into how this operates, maybe at the sort of macro level in terms of American Marxism, but specifically in this space of students.
Well, I think the there's a huge a number of Chinese students, for example, at NYU where I taught, and they were extremely ignorant regarding China's history, I noted. For example, they had no idea about anything to do with the Cultural Revolution or the Great Leap Forward. So they're being systematically miseducated regarding China's past, and it's probably its present as well.
And those, of course, were events in which the tyranny of the Chinese Communist Party was absolutely manifest, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was extraordinary, an extraordinary display of wickedness and, malfeasance and murderous intent. They are basically being sent over here, I think, to, first of all, gain what they can out of the American system and more or less exploit it. And then I think they are deliberately trained to ignore China's flaws. And then they are effectively being policed by the Chinese government. They're nervous beyond words about falling afoul of that system. And then, of course, we have the recent Biden administration decision to allow the Chinese Confucius Institutes to flourish in the United States, whereas Trump had tried to curtail them. Now these Confucius Institutes are being allowed, there's no restrictions on them. And of course, these Confucius Institutes are a means of indoctrination, but also they could involve, and they most likely do involve, espionage. So,
and keeping eyes on those students
Keeping eyes on post surveillance and espionage.
Yeah,
I'd say the overarching task is surveillance.
Right.
That's the bigger task.
I'm aware that the Confucius Institutes, which were being shut down in a number of places, were being reopened under a new name. But I didn't realize that the Biden administration, on top of all of the other services it's been rendering to the Chinese Communist Party, I'm sorry to say, is actually allowing these things to flourish once again.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. That's a very, very dangerous development.
Yeah, that's in the last few days. Yeah.
Is that right? Oh,
yeah.
Gosh. Well, we'll be drilling down on that, needless to say, because they feature prominently in the indictment as part of the attack on our country that has been, well, we think characterized by war crimes, in fact. Let me ask you to talk a little bit about the Chinese Communist Party and the partnership that it has with seemingly unlikely capitalists, the global type, at the World Economic Forum and beyond. And the thesis of your piece is that the reset is a sort of shared enterprise, is it not?
Yes. Well, I think at least for what China serves as, first and foremost for these globalists, is the model for the West. So they're looking at the Chinese system, the, you know, socialism with Chinese characteristics, or which I call capitalism with Chinese characteristics. They're looking at that as the model to roll out across the world. And they've said this in many instances. Maurice Strong said it. He was Klaus Schwab's mentor. Klaus Schwab himself has said it. And many of the CEOs of major corporations have said it, in effect. Of course, Trudeau has said that would, you know, wonderful if we could have kind of Chinese totalitarianism. There's the model aspect. And then there is cooperation and actual coordination between these, what I call in the West, the subversive elites, and these captured elites, and the Chinese Communist Party, and many of its players. So I traced the connection between a lot of these Chinese players, some of them actually governmental figures who are involved in the roundtable groups that have coordinated the Great Reset, including the World Economic Forum. And there are over 70 Chinese companies that are partners with the World Economic Forum. There are Chinese nationals who sit on the World Economic Forum's Board of Trustees. So there's this.
And one other point, sir, which I didn't know myself until fairly recently, we were endlessly told about Davos, the place where these folks get together once a year in Switzerland, and it's become synonymous with the World Economic Forum. And yet it also meets every year in communist China, does it not?
Yes.
What is the likelihood that that has some bearing on everything else that you've just talked about?
Yeah, I mean, they have, so these people are either naive or nefarious in their outlook regarding China. Either they believe that they can bring China into this globalist agenda and have their model spread across the earth without any real Chinese gain being undertaken. In other words, without China becoming the dictator of the world, or else they think that they don't care if China becomes the dictator of the world. And that's probably more likely.
And that they'll prosper.
And that they'll prosper at the expense of the West, because these people have had a hatred for Western lifestyles, Western way of life for decades, you know, going back to the UN's declarations about Western consumption and even reproduction.
Right, but as a serious student of these things, what is the likelihood that these fellow travelers, or whatever you want to call them, will in fact prosper should the Chinese?
That's a great question. I mean, they don't know much about history, I suppose, because likely they will be rendered, they will be treated like the useful idiots that they are. In other words, they'll be destroyed.
Taken up and shot, I think, is the typical response, is it not? I think not only a bit of an historian, I think it's fair to say, but also a student of political systems. I want to go back to something you touched on earlier, Dr. Michael Recknewald, and that is this idea that it's socialism with Chinese characteristics.
Right.
Or alternatively, capitalism with Chinese characteristics. I wonder whether it doesn't come down to more or less fascism.
It's fascism. It's
the state and these corporations are really joined at the hip. Isn't that
basically the bottom line? Yeah, it's technically fascism is what it is, economic fascism. You have this total collusion between the state and these corporations. Then you have these favored corporations who get protection from the state, and they get monopolies, effectively shared monopolies. And that's exactly what these Western corporate oligarchs want. And this is why China is so appealing to them, the model, as a model now. And again, they're probably enabling China. They are definitely enabling China's growth and economic viability with their investments, like Larry Fink, who set up with BlackRock, set up the first on land Chinese investment capital group.
Western one.
Yep, the first Western one in China itself. So,
As we talk about in the indictment, Larry Fink is possibly the poster child of these captured elites, rendered incalculably huge services to the Chinese, migrating our money to China, which they've used for their, dangerous purposes.
And some of the investments have been very instrumental in subjugating, surveilling, and, oppressing the Uyghurs in Xinjiang.
So, well, the first charge, Dr. Recknewald, in this book is crimes against humanity. And to the extent that, friends of China here have been enabling it all the more shameful. Yeah. We have to leave it at that, sir. Thank you for your time, as well as the many contributions you're making to freedom today. We appreciate you, Dr. Michael Recknell. Come back to us soon. Be right back with more Dr. Harold Rode on the Mideast and more right after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The Chinese Communist Party is the United States' mortal enemy. It explicitly seeks America's destruction and has long pursued that goal using devastating, albeit pre-violent, unrestricted warfare techniques with help from their friends among American captured elites. Now the Chinese Communists appear poised to start a shooting war against Taiwan and almost certainly U.S. assets, personnel, and territory as well. Too many Americans are still unaware of these realities and what we must do to secure our country against them. I'm pleased to announce the publication today of my new book aimed at correcting that perilous situation. It's entitled The Indictment and a Playbook for Prosecuting the CCP and Friends for their crimes against America, China, and the world. Get The Indictment wherever books are sold to learn how we can punish that transnational criminal organization and secure freedom. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest, a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy, a man of considerable distinction and accomplishment in both the legislative and executive branches of our government. He was a staff director of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee for a time, a deputy undersecretary of defense in the Reagan administration, back when men were men, let me add, and he has been active in the public policy arena, notably with the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs and other organizations, helping to shape the war of ideas as well as our military capabilities, not least as a senior executive at Finmeccanica, a major defense contracting firm. So with all of that expertise, Steve Bryan is his name. It's a man that we very much appreciate taking counsel from on issues of the day. Dr. Bryan, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Nice to be with you, Frank. Thanks for the nice introduction.
Thank you. Well, listen, I hardly know where to begin. There's so much to talk with you about. But one thing that caught my eye is in Asia Times, you had a piece about drone warfare. You were talking about a specific application of it, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But I thought I might just back the lens up a bit. Steve, as a guy with a lot of experience in the national security arena, are we looking at a major transformation of the art of war with the advent of relatively inexpensive and widely proliferated, not only aerial unmanned vehicles, as they call them, but also drones, if you will, on the land and at sea, yeah, and underwater for that matter?
There we are. I mean, I think it's a real phenomenon in warfare that is well established now. The Israelis were the first ones to really develop it and use it effectively against Lebanon, that war, back in the 80s. But since then, you had the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict where drones played a very big role. And now in Ukraine, you're seeing the same thing. And you're seeing them all over the Middle East. I mean, they're everywhere.
And they're, in fact, in the hands of non-military elements, terrorists and others.
Yeah. I mean, there's no short,
used because they're cheap. Troops in Iraq, right? In Syria?
They're cheap, and no one wants to enforce export controls to stop supply of the parts. And they're easy to put together. So you can make a pretty good drone.
And Steve, one of the things that I understood was that the Chinese are the principal suppliers of drones in our market.
In the commercial market, yeah, they got over 80% of it.
But there's, as I understand it also, there's a fair amount of use of commercial drones for military purposes as well, right?
Yeah.
So is and you had a very, very important role playing the monitor and controller of technology flows to the old Soviet Union back in the Reagan years.
Right.
Is export control really an option even for parts at this point?
It is for the advanced drones. I don't think for the cheapies, you know, there's much you can do. But the advanced ones are increasingly using sophisticated computers and some artificial intelligence, things like that, which are based on little chips that the U.S. controls. I wouldn't say we make them, but we control it. It's not Chinese. So there's possibility of restricting that stuff. The Biden administration claimed it was going to do it, but it hasn't done anything. It's a waste of time.
Okay. And it could still.
It could very well. Yeah. Yeah. They stopped selling AI chips to Ukraine. I mean, to Ukraine, sorry, to China. They won't sell them to China, but they're all over the place otherwise. So you can't control things like that.
Yeah. Steve, let me just ask you, in terms of these unmanned vehicles, is it fair to describe them as an equalizer for relatively unsophisticated militaries, both for surveillance and for actual ordnance delivery against
Look at what Azerbaijan is, a small country. Look what they did against Armenia. They kicked them very hard with drones that they got from Israel and from Turkey. And they did amazing things with them. They knocked out their radars, they knocked out their missile launchers, they killed a lot of their troops. I mean, they were very effective.
Again, maybe not a good thing, depending on how you look
at facts.
That particular conflict. Yeah. Let me ask you about this ostensible drone attack against the Kremlin on the 3rd of May. You've written about it again at Asia Times. What do you make of it, and what questions are still outstanding there?
Well, I was the first one to point out that these drones were launched very close to the Kremlin. They weren't drones that covered the territory across Russia and then into Moscow and then to the Kremlin. I think the Russian air defenses would have picked them up. In any case, I don't think that's how it was done. I think they were done locally. Now, the question is who done it? The Russians say it was the Ukrainians and the United States. But others say, well, maybe it was the Russians in a kind of false flag operation. I don't happen to think that was the case. I think it was probably a Ukrainian operation.
Well, and your reason for discounting the idea that it was Putin engineering this is that this is kind of embarrassing that somebody would have gotten inside the Kremlin. He was not there at the time, interestingly enough. And yeah. So the question of whether or not it posed an actual threat to him, as I also understand he doesn't live in the Kremlin, so it attack on the Kremlin itself at night.
It was psychological.
Designed to shake people's confidence more than...
The Russians have put in a very sophisticated and layered air defense system around Moscow, and they keep improving it. And this, you know, when you can hit the Kremlin, for God's sake, it looks pretty bad. And that's why I think it was a Ukrainian operation, because it embarrassed Putin.
Would it surprise you that they're able to operate close to the Kremlin?
It's interesting. You know, they've been carrying out sabotage operations all over Russia, not just on the eastern part, but even, you know, as far away as Moscow. They've been assassinating people, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, there's no doubt those were Ukrainian.
And attacks on infrastructure as well.
And infrastructure, oil depots, so forth. Yeah.
Steve, hold the thought. We're going to come back in just a moment and we'll carry on with some of the capabilities that the United States has that it seems to be determined to get rid of at the moment. We'll be right back with more with Stephen Bryan right after this. Welcome back. We are visiting with Dr. Stephen Bryan, a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy, the author of an important book recently about Taiwan and what we need to do to try to protect it against attack by the Chinese Communist Party and its People's Liberation Army. Steve, one of the other things that you've written about recently at, again, Asia Times, is a element of the U.S. Air Force capability, specifically to support combat operations on the ground and suppress right. attacks on our forces there, is an aircraft called the A-10. It was introduced, as I recall, back in our day. It's been
even before.
Even before? Well,
yeah,
it's got a lot of military combat to its credit. As I recall, the Air Force has never much cared for this thing, and it certainly has been determined to get rid of it from the inventory for quite some time. Remind us what this so-called Warthog is and why it's of continued value and why the Air Force is so determined to get rid of it.
Well, it's a very lethal ground attack aircraft that has a huge gun, a 30-millimeter Gatling gun that is devastating. And it can drop bombs, including smart bombs. So it's pretty versatile. That's the plus. The minus is that it's slow. It's subsonic. But almost every ground attack airplane is going to be flying subsonic when it's striking targets. I mean, there's no way out of that. Close air support is close air support. And the Air Force doesn't like it. They never liked it. They never wanted it.
But is it, as much as anything, they don't like the mission and that this idea that there's a joint force in which the Air Force is providing support to the Army and the Marines and, you know, vice versa? Is that just not applying here?
The Air Force would say, no, they support the mission, but they don't like the way the A-10 goes about it. They want to use 21st century weapons like the stealth aircraft, F-35, to go after targets like a tank. It doesn't make any sense. So I think that the dispute is over rather using modern technology, the latest, the greatest, which the Air Force is all about, or using old stuff, which they don't want to use. They don't want to maintain old stuff. They want new stuff. By the way, in fairness to the Air Force, they're very short on airplanes. They've worn out a lot of airplanes in Iraq and Afghanistan. And really, they're in some trouble on that. And we should support getting more modern airplanes for the Air Force. It's very important. But I also would like to support the A-10 because I think it still has a role to play, a very significant one, in U.S. security. Oh, yeah. I mean, they've upgraded them and modernized them. And, you know, it's a very robust platform. It's simple, but
lethal, as you say.
Very lethal.
And cost effective is the other piece of this. And you were doing some comparisons in your piece.
There almost isn't any. I mean,
operating costs.
About $6,000 an hour to fly the A-10. An F-16 costs about $27,000 an hour. I mean, it's very, very cost effective. And of course, it's been in service for many years. So its sunk costs have been amortized a long time ago. So it's cost us nothing but flight hours maintenance.
And the survivability of the platform, especially in a ground attack mode, you don't want to be putting a very, very expensive F-35 in that, as you say, subsonic bomb dropping or other sort of ordnance.
Well, yeah, I mean, nowadays the trend is to use standoff weapons because you can't bring an F-35 in close. It won't survive. Because once it's flying toward a target, it becomes visible. You hear it, you see it, you shoot at it. So you don't. You now use a thing that flies 40 miles away or 50 miles away and is guided to the target with a GPS and with TV and everything else. But for supporting troops, that's not very good because you can't pre-program. You've got to be almost, you got to be called in by ground spotters who say, hey, the guys are over there on that hill. Can you get rid of them? That's exactly how it was used in Afghanistan with terrific success.
And unfortunately, there are places on the planet now and maybe in the near future where that kind of capability is going to be.
Yeah, and also keep in mind that even though it was designed in the 1970s, it was designed to knock out Russian armor in the Fulda Gap. But the thesis was that the Russian air defenses would have been taken out by U.S. strategic bombers or by, you know, F-15s, F-16s, that kind of thing. So when you brought in the A-10s, the other stuff that could kill them was already killed, was already destroyed. So then it could just pound away at these things. And it uses depleted uranium shells. It's very, very lethal.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about those depleted uranium rounds. There's an effort being made at the United Nations, as I understand it, to ban them on the grounds that when used, they can scatter uranium, you know, traces on the targets and in the surrounding areas. Is that something that makes sense for us to participate in?
No. Well, we couldn't because all our tank ammunition uses depleted uranium. We don't have anything else. The A-10 uses depleted uranium and probably some other weapons. So it's not practical to get rid of it. It would take years.
Yeah. And we, I gather, good company in that rejection by the Russians and the Chinese.
And the British.
Is that right? And the British.
Yeah, the British use it.
My experience with arms control is that these things usually work to the detriment of the good guys, in this case, us.
That's the whole purpose of arms control.
It certainly is.
To penalize the good guys.
We want to avoid getting into this fix, in this case, I think it's fair to say.
I don't think there's much risk of that, though. I think that no U.S. administration, at least any sensible one, is going to ever take them out of service.
I'm not sure this one qualifies as that, Steve.
Well, I was careful there. I said any sensible one.
You parsed your words carefully, but I think we're dealing with one that might just do it. Anyway, yeah. We'll be following this closely with your help. Steve Bryan, thank you very much for the work you do these days with us at the Center for Security Policy.
Thank you, Frank.
Your output is tremendous and valuable. We appreciate it. Come back to us soon. Hope the rest of you will do the same next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.